Talking about Saul Bellow in an evening like this is like trying to fit a continent into a shoebox. But it's a pleasure to return to his work, and I hope that you'll excuse me for covering so little about so very much more that could be said. I'll start in May 1949, a year after the establishment of Israel. The American Jewish literary critic Leslie Fiedler published in Commentary magazine an essay about the fundamental challenge facing Jewish writers who were then penetrating Anglo-American literature. Entitled, What Can We Do About Fagin? Fagin being the Jewish villain of Charles Dickens's novel Oliver Twist. The essay shows that the modern Jew who adopts English as his language is joining a culture which is riddled with negative stereotypes of himself. These demonic images figure in some of the best works of some of the best writers, forming an indelible part of the English literary tradition. So Jews who are moving out of Jewish languages and Talmudic tradition to make their mark in English are therefore up against powerful representations of themselves as Shylock and Fagin, or in the poet T.S. Eliot's memorable image, the rats are underneath the piles, the Jew is underneath the lot. So how then should Jewish writers proceed on this inhospitable ground? Now there was a paradox in the timing of this essay, since this was actually the post-war moment when a mass of Jewish thinkers and entertainers had moved into the forefront of American of Anglo-American literature. The cohort of New York intellectuals whom we've been speaking about, the first European-style intelligentsia on American soil, clustered around several magazines and publishing houses, were by then gaining prominence as writers, critics, and professors. So Fiedler was not a petitioner requesting permission to enter American letters, but someone already in place. Indeed, by the end of the essay, after laying out the problem, he proposes this answer. We can begin to build rival myths of our meaning for the Western world, other images of the Jew, to dispossess the ancient images of terror. Several of varying dignity and depth are already in existence. The happy Hebrew peasant of the New Israel, the alienated Jew as artist, as in Kafka's K, the protagonist Joseph K, the dilettante, Proust's Charles Swann, or Citizen, James Joyce's Leopold Bloom, the sensitive young victim of the recent crop of American war novels, and the ambiguous figure of Saul Bellow's novel, both victim and oppressor. So according to Fiedler, the response to existing negative stereotypes would be the creation of self-directed representations, and the modern Jew could possibly become the new everyman of a society where everyone feels somewhat marginal. It is striking to me that in charting this proposed new path of Jewish fiction, Fiedler singles out for mention not Middle of the Journey, which was Lionel Trilling's 1947 novel with non-Jewish characters, but Saul Bellow's second novel, The Victim, published the same year, 1947, about a New York Jew who is being stalked by an anti-Semite. I think it was an auspicious choice of writer and book. Saul Bellow, by now the subject of several biographies, including the so far definitive two-volume Life by Zachary Leder, was born in a suburb of Montreal in 1915 to a traditional Jewish family that had recently arrived from Russia. Raised in Chicago, where his family moved when he was 9 years old, he became part of a circle of brainy Jewish teenagers who read and debated books like Oswald Spengler's Decline of the West. They learned much more from one another than they ever learned from their formal schooling, including in Bellow's case at the University of Chicago and Northwestern University. He decided early on to become a writer, And he worked at it so hard and successfully that by the time of his death in 2005, he had become America's most decorated novelist, recipient of, among many other honors, the 1976 Nobel Prize for Literature, 3 National Book Awards for Fiction, a Pulitzer Prize, and the American Academy of Arts and Letters Gold Medal for the novel. France made him a commander of the Legion of Honor. Italy awarded him the Malaparte Prize, and Israel awarded him the Agnon Prize for literary achievement. But back then, in 1947, aged 32 and just starting out, Bello must have shared Fiedler's sense of entering a culture that was prejudiced against him, because The Victim shows him tackling this issue head on. And here's how the novel opens. On some nights, New York is as hot as Bangkok. The whole continent seems to have moved from its place and slid nearer the equator, the bitter gray Atlantic to have become green and tropical, and the people thronging the streets, barbaric Philachin, among the stupendous monuments of their mystery, the lights of which, a dazing profusion, climb endlessly into the heat of the sky. Now, this description of New Yorkers as barbaric Asians feels very odd until you realize that this was how Henry James described New York in his 1907 coverage of the American scene. And I quote, "There is no swarming like that of Israel when once Israel has got a start. And the scene here bristled at every step with the signs and sounds imitable, unmistakable, of a Jewry that has burst all bounds. With the exception of some shy corner of Asia, no district in the world known to the statistician has so many inhabitants to the yard," and so on. So for his novel about anti-Semitism, Bello slyly adapts the view of America's greatest novelist. Henry James viewed the city as an alien outpost of Asia, where an Anglo-Saxon descendant of the Puritans feels totally displaced. And just as Fiedler suggested, here was Bello creating his own image, but now through the counter image of the anti-Jew. So on this steamy summer evening, as our Jewish protagonist, Asa Leventhal, gets off the Third Avenue train and makes his way home to his apartment, he has the sense that he is being followed. The stalker is Kirby Albee, a man he scarcely remembers having once met, who blames Leventhal for having ruined his life. That's the main plot in a nutshell. Leventhal is living on his own while his wife is away taking care of her aging mother. He is trying to hold down his job, take care of the family of his out-of-town brother, and stay in touch with a couple of people he knows. He feels lucky to have attained this modest security that he has, and lucky, as he puts it, that he is not one of the lost, the outcast, the overcome, the effaced, the ruined, who are all around him in the city. He may be otherwise unconfident, but he is certain that he never wronged his accuser. Now, Albee, on the other hand, is a recovering alcoholic, somewhat of a misfit, who fits Leventhal's stereotype of the anti-Semite, yet it turns out that he may actually have a real gripe. Leventhal had once said something that may have prevented Albee from getting a break just when he was down and out and needed one. Also, Albee genuinely doubts that Jews can become the transmitters of American values and culture. He is worried that the works of Ralph Waldo Emerson are now being taught by someone named Lifshitz. So, in exploring the mutual distrust between Leventhal and Albee, Bello was by no means drawing a moral equivalence between the Jew and his accuser. That possibility is raised and rejected in the novel, because when Leventhal, speaking to a friend of his, tries to explain Albee's complaint against the Jews, the friend gets really angry. No, no. and you're trying to do something for him? You're willing regardless? Boy, do you know what that does to my opinion of you? Are you in your right mind? Leventhal knows that he bears no real responsibility for Albee's failures, and he refuses to accept any blame for them. But he does begin to understand the Gentile in return for being better understood by him. Though Bello later said that he had not yet hit his stride in writing this novel, it was very important in his thinking about America. Anti-Semitism was the monstrous destroyer of civilization in Europe, but America had gone to war to defeat fascism in Europe, and he did not want the anti-Jewish bigotry of someone like Albee to be mistaken for murderous Hitlerism, the he there being Bello. As Albee explains to Leventhal, you know, Moses punished the Egyptians with darkness, and that's how I often think of this. When I was born, when I was a boy, everything was different. We thought it would be daylight forever. Do you know one of my ancestors was Governor Winthrop? Now, he was referring to John Winthrop, the governor of colonial Massachusetts. His voice vibrated fiercely. There was a repressed laugh in it. I'm a fine one to be talking about tradition, you must be saying. But still, I was born into it. And try to imagine how New York affects me. Isn't it preposterous? It's really as if the children of Caliban were running everything. You go down in the subway and Caliban gives you 2 nickels for a dime. You go home and he has a candy store on the street where you were born. The old breeds are out. The streets are named after them. But what are they themselves? Just remnants. Now, Leventhal resists this appeal for sympathy, but the novel asks that we understand Albee and shows the two antagonists gradually, painfully, and imperfectly overcoming the other's fears. Encouraging trust is no simple matter. Both these Americans have reasons for their paranoia. Now, that no one should think of themselves as victims in America is part of the larger idea at the heart of this novel. And that larger idea takes shape in a cafeteria scene where 5 Jews, Leventhal among them, are discussing the performance by an actress in a recent film. And Schlossberg, the oldest and most learned Jew among them, criticizes the actress for underacting, for reacting to the murder of her husband with too little human feeling. Acting, he says, should convey the full worth of the human being. And after discussing various film portrayals of Queen Victoria, they naturally shift, naturally because they're Jews, so Queen Victoria will bring, the idea of Benjamin Disraeli, who served as her prime minister. And Leventhal expresses discomfort with this great statesman. He says, Disraeli wanted to lead England, in spite of the fact that he was a Jew, not because he cared about empires so much. People laughed at his nose, so he took up boxing. They laughed at his poetic silk clothes, so he put on black. And they laughed at his books, so he showed them. He got into politics and became the prime minister. He did it all on nerve. Leventhal does not want the Jews to have to prove themselves. And this leads Schlossberg into a spontaneous speech on what is the proper balance between over and under acting. An actor may not have to prove anything, yet he can still reach for beauty and greatness. If a human life is a great thing to me, it is a great thing. Why be measly? Do you have to be? Is someone holding you by the neck? Have dignity. You understand me? Choose dignity. Nobody knows enough to turn it down. Now, to whom should this mean something if not to an actor? If he isn't for dignity, then I tell you there's a great mistake somewhere. So for actor in this passage, I think we can read Jew or novelist. What is said about acting applies to fiction and to the life that fiction describes. The Jewish writer and the character who is his fictional stand-in should neither over-dramatize nor minimize the hostility that they face, but keep reaching for dignity on their own terms. The Jewish writer is not obliged to present any counter myth or to proceed like Disraeli on nerve, but neither should he lower his expectations of man made in the image of God. So rather than remaining stuck in the polarized Nazi-driven categories of anti-Semite versus Jew, Bello sounds another possibility that approaches what Zev Jabotinsky called hadar, dignity or nobility. In immigrant-driven New York, the Jew does not have to display the distortions of his former diaspora existence by overcompensating for his insecurities. It's unworthy of the American to import European anti-Semitism into America, and dishonest of the Jew to pretend that he is at that level of danger. Bello valued the novel for its ability to display the human being fully, especially in a fully liberated society. I linger over this early work because its temperate understanding of America explains why Bello could aspire to become its greatest writer. Now, The Victim, this book that I've been speaking about, is often shortchanged in studies of Saul Bellow because it came right before his artistic breakthrough in The Adventures of Augie March. Bellow himself liked to describe that breakthrough. After several rejections, he had won a Guggenheim Fellowship in 1948, and he was in Paris trying to write the novel that he had outlined for the project, but the work was not going well. And then, in an inspired moment, he heard in his head the voice of a Chicago kid, someone he knew in his adolescence. Probably fused with other influences, like Mark Twain's Huck Finn and Sholem Aleichem's Muttel Pesi, the Cantor's Son, that his father had read aloud to the family in his childhood, out came one of the most famous openings in American literature. I am an American, Chicago born, Chicago, that somber city, and go at things as I have taught myself, freestyle, and will make the record in my own way, first to knock, first admitted, sometimes an innocent knock, sometimes not so innocent. But a man's character is his fate, says Heraclitus, and in the end there isn't any way to disguise the nature of the knocks by the acoustical work on the door or gloving the knuckles. So I think one can imagine Bello's excitement at having hit on the narrative style that would then serve him with variations for the rest of his life. Augie March appeared in 1953 when Jews and Jewish writers, entertainers, and critics were reaching the peak of their liberal popularity. When the cadavers of the Holocaust brought American Jews pity and the defenders of Israel gave them pride. This newfound confidence accounts for Augie's buoyancy, a new species of Jewish American. He is free to chart his own path. Though Bello was not an American Chicago born, he grants his hero that advantage while liberating him from parental Jewish supervision by making him the fatherless son of a weak mother. Freedom for Augie means not sex and drugs and irresponsibility, but the right to try out all available options. Augie is the antithesis of John Steinbeck's Depression Victims, of F. Scott Fitzgerald's disenchanted Great Gatsby, and of Ernest Hemingway's tight-lipped heroes who equate manhood with bullfighting. Augie proves himself an occasional schlemiel, a flop at many things, but in no way is he resigned to lead a disappointed life. And he leaves us at the end of the book with this thought. Columbus too thought he was a flop, probably, when they sent him back in chains, which didn't prove there was no America. So biographies and memoirs of Bello tell us all about his own marriages and affairs, his sometime neglect of his children, his finances and quarrels. But what comes through is how he subordinated everything else to his writing and used the setbacks in his life to keep probing what Balzac called the human comedy or the human condition in full. Here are some examples of how he did this. In a country that encourages success and rewards you for achieving it, what does one do with failure? How does a man approaching middle age feel when his marriage fails, he's out of work, and when he cannot live up to the expectations of his father? Incidentally, something that Bello could never do. Of that distress came the character of Tommy Wilhelm in Seize the Day. Or what about betrayal? The husband who is cuckolded, as Bello was, by his best friend, is literature's oldest prototype of the fool. So what do all the genius advice givers, past and present, have to offer someone who has been thus humiliated? Of that came the novel Herzog. And then there are the large questions of mortality and death. Can it be that when someone dies, say someone as Bello's contemporary Delmore Schwartz, can people simply pass out of life? Or must there be some larger, encompassing, transcendent reality that reconnects the dead and the living? Is it just quackery to consider a spiritual science like anthroposophy? Bello raises these questions in Humboldt's Gift. The book that Bello called his favorite was Henderson the Rain King, probably because it was the most fun to write. It makes fun of the American male's midlife crisis by taking him to an imaginary Africa where he has some wisdom knocked into him in a warlike tribe named the Wariri. This seriously comic novel, which was politically incorrect even in 1959, is totally out of bounds today, which may be reason enough to read it and enjoy it. Certainly for people like the ones gathered in this room. Yet just as Henderson returns from the spoof of Africa to everyday America, so does Bello in the novels and stories that followed. He writes about his travels to Israel, but he calls that book To Jerusalem and Back, making it clear that his experience of and admiration for that country is that of an American Jew. In private conversation, I once asked Bello how come he and his Jewish friends, who were then in their 20s, paid so little attention to what was done to the Jews of Europe during the Second World War. And he said, America wasn't a country to us, it was the world. I took this to mean that they were fully absorbed by their immediate challenges and opportunities to the exclusion of everything else. Bello was and remained fully and completely riveted to America. And yet, as the country changed, the once eager boy who had wanted to occupy a place of prominence in its culture began to fear for that culture. Henry James and his fictional Kirby Albee may once have dreaded the Jewish invasion of New York. But by the late 1960s, the New Englanders had been swept away, and it was the Jewish intellectuals who had assumed the role of America's cultural guardians. And they were now the ones afraid for its future. And I think that we've seen this in the previous sessions of this series, in the writings of Delmore Schwartz, Robert Warshaw, Irving Kristol, and Milton Himmelfarb. Bello gave voice to that fear for this country through the character of Arthur Samler, a new kind of Jewish everyman, was the refugee from Europe. So Mr. Samler's Planet, written at the end of the 1960s, was on the New York Times bestseller list for 4 months. And when one reads this book now, I don't think it enters any American classroom. You just have to see the difference between this book being on the bestseller list for 4 months. Until that time, Bello's literary focus had been the individual in all his complexity. He felt that modern man was being bombarded intellectually and emotionally and pulled in myriad directions, and he hoped that the novel could offset the forces of disintegration by featuring the somehow still coherent human being at its center. But as the title suggests, Mr. Samler's planet shifts the emphasis from the main character to the society that he is navigating. If America is that exceptional place on our planet, what happens if American civilization should disintegrate? To pose this question, Bellow needed a character with greater moral authority and tougher experience than his. So though he habitually wrote from the perspective of someone close to him in age, he created for Arthur Samler a counter-biography. Samler is in his 70s, almost two decades older than Bellow at the time of writing, and a foreigner to America, born in Poland, educated in Europe, and a journalist there in the 1930s, he is then trapped back in Poland as a Jew. Left for dead, he digs his way out of a mass grave where his wife remains buried, lives to fight among partisans, loses an eye, and recovers his daughter from the convent where he and his wife had hidden her. After the war, father and daughter are brought to America by a relative of his wife, and there we meet Samler on New York's Upper West Side. His experience has transformed the once spoiled little boy into what we know as a survivor. It took Bellow many drafts and revisions to craft the figure of Samler, a Jewish product of the 20th century, scarred yet free of cynicism, a professional observer who reminds us that in the country of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And that is stated in the novel about Samler. So here's a quotation. Like many people who had seen the world collapse once, Mr. Samler entertained the possibility it might collapse twice. He did not agree with refugee friends that this doom was inevitable. But liberal beliefs did not seem capable of self-defense, and you could smell decay. You could see the suicidal impulses of civilization pushing strongly. So uncommonly alert, thanks to having learned the skills of survival, Samler sees, for example, a black pickpocket on his bus route. But after a vain attempt to alert the police, he discovers that he has no protection against this man. His daughter Shula steals a manuscript because she thinks it will be valuable to her father. A casualty of the war, she is morally careless and perpetually frazzled. The American-born children of Dr. Elia Gruner, the relative who sponsored and continues to support him, are even lower down the moral continuum. Angela is a promiscuous casualty of the sexual revolution with what her father calls fucked out eyes. And the son Wallace flits from one enthusiasm to the other, resisting all responsibility. Living near Columbia University, Samler is invited by a student to speak on the British scene in the 30s, which he experienced. As he speaks about H.G. Wells and the Bloomsbury Group, and George Orwell. Someone in the audience interrupts, "Why do you listen to this effete old shit? What has he got to tell you? His balls are dry. He's dead. He can't come." Samler is driven from the auditorium, quote, "not so much personally offended by the event as struck by the unbridled will of a young American student simply to offend." He says, "What a passion to be real. But real was also brutal. And the acceptance of excrement as a standard, how extraordinary. Youth, together with the idea of sexual potency, all this confused sex, excrement, militancy, explosiveness, abusiveness, tooth showing, Barbary ape howling, or like the spider monkeys in the trees," as Samler had once read, "defecating into their hands and shrieking, pelting the explorers below." So in fact, Something like this had happened to Bellow himself when he spoke at San Francisco State University. And in this scene, he was thus able to get in the last word about that incident. But like the novelist, Samler observes the collapse of society without being able to correct it. His wisdom is without power, and the youngsters who wield the power are at the level of spider monkeys. Now, Bellow crams the 48 hours of this book with incident and ideas enough to constitute a whole course on Western civilization. And parenthetically, Samler has even managed two trips to Israel, one of them during the Six-Day War. So maybe in the future, Tikva can devote a course to this novel. But for now, I'll pick out from all its eventfulness just the theme that gets us back to the opening question of what it means to be neither more nor less than fully human. Despite Samler's fears for his planet, which are amply illustrated in the book, he does find a positive model. And he finds him in the generally most vilified, derided, and caricatured figure of modern fiction. This is Elia Gruner, the relative who has brought Samler to America, the middle-class husband and father who stands out only in relation to the others around him. But that is enough for Samler, just as it's enough in the Talmudic teaching, b'makom she'ein ish, she'ein anashim, tishtadel lihiyot ish. Where there are no men, try to be a man. So Gruner emerges as the hero, not in any absolute terms, but in relation to what Samler experienced and witnessed in Europe, and in relation to what he now sees in America. Over the course of the novel's 48 hours, Elia Gruner lies in a hospital bed, suffering from an aneurysm. We learn his virtues and his flaws. He contributes to Israel and visits there regularly, part of a strong family feeling that made him rescue the Samlers and continue supporting them. Yet, he has fatally indulged his children rather than being a strong father to them. He has performed illegal abortions for some of his shadier patients and hidden the money from the IRS. Yet, he was a conscientious doctor and generous in his dealings. When Gruner dies in the book's final pages, Samler's closing private prayer for the dead man adapts the traditional Kaddish to the Jew who has dutifully performed his mission on earth. And this is a passage that asks to be read aloud, and it is often quoted. Remember God, the soul of Elia Gruner, who, as willingly as possible and as well as he was able, and even to an intolerable point, and even in suffocation, and even as death was coming, was eager, even childishly, perhaps may I be forgiven for this, even with a certain servility, to do what was required of him. Now, the repetition and seemingly overuse of redundant words to enrich the thought echo the cadences of Yisbarach, v'yishtabach, v'yispar, v'yisroman, v'yisnaseh, the praises normally heaped on God and which are also due this man who did what was required of him. And then Samler continues, at his best, this man was much kinder than at my very best I have ever been or could be. He was aware that he must meet, and he did meet, through all the confusion and degraded clowning of this life through which we are speeding, he did meet the terms of his contract, the terms which in his inmost heart each man knows, as I know mine, as all know, for that is the truth of it, that we all know God, that we know, we know, we know. Now, the words meeting the terms of his contract evoke the Jews' covenantal arrangement with the God of Sinai. But in Elia Gruner, they are already ingrained in his inmost heart. Samler would not have known the Kaddish. It's the author who gives Samler these words. By repeating five times, "we know," are Bellow and Samler trying to convince themselves? Some critics, like Benjamin DeMott, accuse Bellow of gratuitous optimism, implying that the evidence provided in this novel does not warrant the confidence of that final prayer. I think, rather, that Samler channels the deepest sources of Bellow's faith, without which he couldn't have issued this warning against everything that now threatens America. And if it threatened it then in the late 1960s, we have come a long way farther down that road. Author and character jointly remind us not to overlook the decency of the imperfect Jewish bourgeois gentleman, the citizen who performs his duty. Samler may be the survivor, but the imperfect American Jew sustains him and Israel and the hopes of this book for civilization. Well, as Saul Bellow later aged, his characters aged with him, and many of his later books are filled with regret. With characters who want to atone for sins of commission and omission, Elia Gruner dies with much to regret, but Mr. Samler survives to praise him, not to be sure with the exalting praise of a Kaddish, but with praise for the good American Jew who does what is required of him. On the whole, when Fiedler suggested creating new Jewish myths for the Western world, he could not have imagined what a wealth of such myths Saul Bellow would provide. Between the victim and Mr. Samler's planet, there emerged the myth of an American Jew, unafraid and grateful. I think it remains for us to absorb and transmit what Bellow knew and what he insists we all know in our inmost hearts. We all also know. Thanks.